Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. Most of us have known someone who has suffered from anorexia nervosa. In some cases, anorectics literally starve themselves to death. Those who work on college campuses are likely more familiar with this extreme form of eating disorder, since it tends to present itself mainly in young, relatively affluent, and intelligent females. Which raises some difficult questions. Why should that be the case? Why does it appear mainly in affluent societies? And what exactly is anorexia nervosa? Is it a physiological disease, a nervous disorder, or an extreme reaction to the media's portrayal of ideal, i.e. thin, feminine beauty? During this hour of Focus 580, we will try to better understand the nature of anorexia nervosa by examining its history in Western culture. Our guest is a scholar whose work on the subject has been very influential to those on the front lines of dealing with eating disorders. Joan Jacobs-Brumberg is a presidential fellow and professor at Cornell University, where she teaches courses in history, human development, and women's studies. She's the author of several books, including the one we'll be discussing during this hour, Fasting Girls, The History of Anorexia Nervosa. Originally published in 1988 by Harvard Press, Fasting Girls won the John Hope Franklin Prize, the Berkshire Book Prize, the Eileen Basker Prize, and the Watson Davis Prize. It has just been updated by the author and republished in paperback by Vintage Books. In Fasting Girls, Joan Jacobs-Brumberg details the surprising history of and reactions to eating disorders seemingly akin to anorexia nervosa and pinpoints the emergence of what we call anorexia nervosa in a particular historical and cultural setting. The history of anorexia nervosa and how that history relates to its increasing incidence today will be the topic for this hour. If you would like to join the conversation, if you have questions, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455, or 333-WILL, that makes it easier to think of. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. Joan Jacobs-Brumberg, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And glad to have you back, although by telephone this time. We had you in the studio, I think, a few months ago when you were in town.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, just to start basic, by now most people probably know something about what we mean by the term anorexia nervosa. But just to be as clear as we can, could you explain what the term means in the present day?
Well, let me explain first the term.
Sure.
Okay. Anorexia nervosa. Anorexia means lack of appetite. And you can have anorexia with, you know, cancer or diabetes or depression. But it was putting anorexia, lack of appetite, together with nervosa, meaning from nervous causes, nervous origin. Then in the 19th century, when the disorder was named and identified, made it very different than kind of normal lack of appetite. What the doctors were conveying then in that term, anorexia nervosa, was that this was something that was kind of mysterious to them, because the anorexia was not from biological causes. It was from nervous causes. It was, to use a contemporary term, psychological, but they didn't, or emotional, but they didn't put it that way. They said it had nervous origins. Today, what is anorexia nervosa? That's a complicated question. I think of it as a multi-determined disorder. Mm-hmm. By that, I mean it involves probably some biology, probably a good heavy dose of psychology, meaning individual familial circumstances or factors, you know, maybe some temperamental ones, some things that have to do with psychosexual development. And then there's the cultural piece, which has to do in the world in which we live. And that has to do with all these messages that you mentioned in your introduction about why and it is that a slim body, particularly these days, a rather emaciated body, is the ideal of female perfection. So that's where the advertising and the media and the fashion all comes in.
Right. Well, and it has relatively recent origins, as you detail in the book. And I wonder if we could talk about the sort of emergence of this this term anorexia nervosa in the 19th century, sort of as a perhaps new form of what had been seen earlier. And in some cases described as a sort of religious fervor, you know, leading to starvation sort of behavior.
Well, most people are surprised that anorexia nervosa originated in the 19th century. I mean, most people think that it's the result of Twiggy, you know, and that it didn't exist very much before the death of Karen Carpenter. So, first of all, yes, you're right. It does emerge in the late 19th century, in the 1870s, actually in England, France, and the United States, almost simultaneously, and that's described in my book, Fasting Girls. But you're asking me, is there an earlier history? And yes, there is. I mean, there is a history of women and girls refusing food, particularly in religious settings in the Middle Ages. In the 13th century, there were some very famous women fasters, such as Catherine of Siena. And that was part of her religious practice. And certainly once she started starving herself, what happened to her body was very much like what happens to the body of a contemporary anorectic. But I think it's a bit of a confusion and a little ahistorical, really, to say that Catherine of Siena was an anorectic, just like I wouldn't call Karen Carpenter a saint. I think that, you know, the pathway in to the food refusal was very, very different. And also in the 13th century, we're not talking about adolescent girls. We're talking about more mature women. And also one rather critical point, and that is that the women who did not eat in the 13th century gave their food to somebody else, to the poor.
Right. And there was a religious, ideological sort of component to it.
That's right. That's right. And there may be, you know, a deep psychological component to it as well that has to do with control of the body and a desire for asceticism. But the context in which the person engaged in the behavior and the context in which people viewed her were certainly very different. And since we don't know of any root underlying biological mechanism yet, I think it's erroneous to to conflate the two.
You mentioned Catherine of Siena. The term, I believe, was anorexia mirabilis.
Mirabilis. Well, mirabilis. That's what 19th century doctors called that form of food refusal, because they knew that it had existed in the past. Uh-huh. And well into the 19th century, there were some cases of young women who claimed that they didn't need to eat. In other words, their religious life, their spirituality led them to refuse food because of their belief system, just the way we have young women today who refuse food because of a secular belief system.
The emergence of Gull's disease, as it might have been called in the 19th century, was named after, well, I guess you know, maybe I shouldn't call it that because he didn't, after all. Dr. Gull was someone who... as you describe in your book, initially described anorexia nervosa.
Right. It was William Withy Gull, G-U-L-L, for those who are listening.
Right. What was different about the circumstances of what he was describing?
Different than?
The previous understanding of anorexia nervosa.
He is the first of the doctors in English language medicine to have a number of young women present themselves to him. Actually, their parents probably presented them.
Yeah.
And asked for assistance. What can we do? Our daughter is wasting away. Wasting was the term that they used. They didn't talk about dieting. They talked about wasting and emaciation and adding flesh to her frame. And so, I mean, that's the context. The context is middle class. I'll say affluent parents who have daughters who are not eating. And they want help, and they need to figure out, is this young woman not eating because she has some kind of biomedical condition? Does she have tuberculosis? Does she have diabetes? You know, does she have cancer? That's the process of differential diagnosis. And Gull figures out that they don't have these other biomedical conditions. This is just a young woman who doesn't eat for some kind of nervous reason. Yet he's not a psychologist. I mean, he's pre-Freudian in a sense. I mean, he just never asked these girls the question, why aren't you eating? Which would have been wonderful for somebody like me who examined his case records, but he doesn't do that. Instead, he simply, you know, says that they must eat regularly. according to an enforced regimen, usually enforced by a trained professional nurse. He gets the idea early on that probably if you take the girl out of her family, that she begins to eat better. I think that's very interesting,
mm-hmm.
right? This observation that there may be a familial component. There may be a way in which the parents are what we would call today enabling the disorder. But over and over again, I mean, you know, Galt treats these young women basically with nutritional therapy, and then he declares them cured when they get up to a regular weight. And unfortunately, we don't have any longitudinal studies of his patients. We don't really know if they really were cured.
Parallel to Dr. Galt, there was a French physician whose work may say more about the family circumstances, as you sort of intimated there.
Right, right. Charles Lesecq. He was a neurologist in Paris. I think his descriptions of anorexia nervosa are much more astute. He talks about the family context. He observes the parents in these cases. And he says that what's going on is that the mother and the father have a certain kind of middle class or bourgeois value system where they're connecting food to love. And so they, and perhaps their cooks, because they're wealthy people, are serving these wonderful foods and trying to entice the appetite of the patient, but she won't give. And he describes the pushing, the offering and the refusal, the offering and the refusal. And he gets at that dynamic and says, you know, really that the family has anorexia nervosa. And in many ways that anticipates the kind of methodological analysis of people today in family systems theory who see anorexia nervosa as associated with a particular kind of enmeshed family. So in that respect, Charles Lesecq was smart and prescient. I mean, he predicted the future in terms of the way in which we look at this thing. It's also very interesting that a French doctor was so offended by the refusal of wonderful food. While the British doctor was not.
Right. Well, you write, the efficacy of food refusal as an emotional tactic within the family depended on foods being plentiful, pleasing, and connected to love. So what we're talking about is a particular historical circumstance that sort of allowed this kind of power play. Or,
That's right.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. First of all, the family has to have the resources to take their daughter to a doctor. But within the context of the family, there has to be enough food and enough investment in the girl so that if she doesn't eat, people don't simply ignore it. I mean, in a working-class family, if somebody didn't eat, somebody else would eat that food, particularly in a poor family. But these are affluent families where there's a lot of meaning in, I'm not taking your most basic form of support. I'm rejecting the love of my parents. That's what this kind of food refusal was about in that context, and it caused a lot of disruption and a lot of unhappiness. Now, there are other reasons that probably contributed to the Victorian anorectic's use of the appetite as a voice. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Use the appetite as a voice. I think there's some other things going on there. I mean, some of it might have to do with marital pressures in adolescence. Some of it might have to do with the fact that girls feel at this point in time that boys have more options. They can't really, most of them, go on in secondary or higher education. There may have been those kinds of conflicts about gender equity without using modern terms. Certainly marital pressure and selection of a spouse would have been something, though, that girls really would have felt. And then I think we also have to look at the culture and see if ideas about female bodies are changing, and I believe that they were at this point in time. I believe that by the 1870s and 1880s, when the first cases of anorexia nervosa are identified, that there is a particular group of young women in this upper-class niche who are beginning to think that a thin body is a lot better than a robust one. And I talk about that in the book, what some of those ideas are.
And this is something we see starting to emerge around that time, at the late Victorian era, where family relationships were changing, the work circumstances and the life options were broadening for at least...
Right, families are also smaller, remember.
Right.
These are girls who don't come from families of six or eight. They're likely to come from a family of two or three. And they're spending more time at home with their family. So the emotional life of the family is more intense.
Just to sort of, you know, bring this back into the 20th century in some sense, the same sorts of issues as this thing we call, modernity or, technological sort of urban educated society spreads throughout the world. We see anorexia nervosa spreading along with that, whereas previously societies that were agricultural-based, more hand labor-based, maybe not as affluent, never experienced it.
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. To return to this issue of why this is related to your question, but also related to what we were just talking about, which is why a Victorian girl might have chosen to refuse food, why she got into anorexia nervosa. This is the point in time when the old relationship between fat and wealth that's characteristic of a traditional society is being overturned. In traditional societies, in agrarian societies, the larger a man's wife and his children, the more successful the man was believed to be, because it was clear that he could provide adequately or plenty of food for those people around him. Well, at the by the end of the 19th century, that relationship is being overturned. Women are increasingly cast as decorative rather than productive. The wealthy man then may want a wife who appears not to work, and so you get indications that women and girls don't want to look like a milkmaid anymore. They want to use their bodies as a symbol of their distance from the working class, and so thinness becomes attractive at that particular point in time for the first time. Now, there are still people, of course, who associate thinness at this point in time with wasting diseases. So it's not a culture like today where everybody wants to be really as slim as they possibly can. But there were reasons in the 19th century. Another reason besides this kind of class distinction linked to the body is the idea that for some women in this time period, again, upper-class women and girls, many of them probably reasoned that a thin body was an indication of spirituality, and that if you conquered your carnal appetites, appetite for food, appetite for sex, you were a better person.
Well, there were distinct messages that said that women shouldn't be seen eating or
That's
something,
right.
Yeah.
The famous quotation from Lord Byron, that a woman should never be seen eating. And there were a lot of secret eaters, in the 19th century. But there are secret eaters today, too. I mean, I've had lots of students at Cornell tell me things like, my roommate won't eat in front of guys.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Well, let me just reintroduce our guest during this hour is Joan Jacobs-Brumberg, author of the book we're discussing, Fasting Girls, The History of Anorexia Nervosa, originally published in 1988, but revised and reissued just this year by Vintage Books. If you would like to join our conversation, you can do so by calling us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. I want to ask you to talk a little bit about the different theoretical models that have been brought to bear in trying to understand anorexia nervosa. That, we perhaps still don't understand exactly what's going on, but there have been sort of competing worldviews, biomedical, psychological, et cetera.
Right. Well, again, I'm a historian,
yeah.
So I'm only reporting to you what others say
sure.
In those cases here. There is a biological model. People say that if they follow this model, that there's probably something going on in the hypothalamus. There's some kind of chemical imbalance in the brain. Now it's linked to serotonin and serotonin receptors. I can't really give you, you know, absolutely correct summaries of all of those at this point. What I can tell you is that nobody has actually proved that the biomedical cause comes first. Mm-hmm. I mean, we really don't know. It's really a chicken and egg problem. Which comes first, the hormonal imbalance, you know, or the starvation? Mm-hmm. The second model, and the other problem with the biomedical model is that it really fails to explain why young women and not young men, and it doesn't really explain why so much anorexia nervosa now.
Or why it seems to affect affluent
women as well. Right, right. So it's the social class address, the gender issue, and then what I'll call the historical timing issue.
Sure.
So, you know, those are problems. And I think most people have come to accept the fact that there might be a biomedical component in anorexia nervosa, but it doesn't appear to be absolutely causative. You know, it's not a single causal model. I mean, the most sophisticated people talk about it as a multi-determined interactive model. So that gets you to psychology. The psychological models really fall into three kind of basic groups, I guess. There's psychoanalytic, there's family systems theory, there's social psychology. In most cases, people think of anorexia nervosa as some kind of pathological response to the developmental crisis of adolescence. I mean, it's really linked to adolescence and to some of the psychosexual difficulties that the girl is going through, and many times people talk about the fact that it's really revolves around issues of individuation, becoming your own person. You know, the anorectic is a very good girl who is really alternating between compliance and rebellion. You know, she's refusing to eat. It's a kind of a form of over control that's very hostile and rebellious, particularly with respect to one's own family. And there are people who talk about the family of the anorectic as being an enmeshed family, meaning that in some way the normal process of separation or individuation is blocked by the psychological needs of the girl and her parents, and maybe even her siblings. In other words, there's some complicated messages going on there, and the family then has the disease as well as the girl. So that's actually harkens back to Charles Lissette. The best known person in terms of the psychological model is probably a writer, author, psychiatrist by the name of Hilda Brook. She wrote a book called The Golden Cage, and it has it's based on case studies of anorectics that she treated in the post-World War II era. You know what the cultural explanation is. I mean, everybody knows that. That's the incessant drumbeat of modern dieting, our veneration of sylph-like women, you know, Twiggy, fashions that require us to have, you know, an absolutely flat stomach and pelvis now, you know, the kind of cult of the perfect body that we live with today. Those are all the cultural contributions. They're deep, they're wide, and there is a lot of psychological evidence that American women have developed something that one psychologist, Judith Rodin, has called the normative obsession. In other words, that, you know, we don't like our bodies, and we're all preoccupied with our weight.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you know, you're right. For example, when and where people become obesophobic, mm-hmm. And dieting becomes pervasive, we can expect to see an escalating number of individuals with anorexia nervosa and other eating disorders.
That's right. So the pathway then into this disorder could be cultural, but you know, it can't be that culture alone causes anorexia nervosa, because if it did, then everybody who lives in the culture should have it. Mm-hmm. So there clearly are intervening individual psychological and biological variables that we need to take into account.
We have a call to talk with. We welcome others. We're a little past our midpoint with Joan Jacobs Brumberg discussing her book, Fasting Girls, The History of Anorexia Nervosa. And we welcome questions if you'd like to join us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. This is a listener in Southeast Illinois on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. Three comments and a question. One, men are blamed for this, but take a look at the men's magazines and take a look at women's magazines and see which one have the anorexic types in them. I mean, men aren't that drawn naturally to anorexic women. They like the like a little flesh on there. A second thing is that in all of these discussions, they never come into the fact that thinness is actually considered healthy, more healthy by doctors. And it would be interesting to see or to know whether medical science in the 19th century had something to do with women being more interested in being thin, because it is actually more healthful. And it could be that to the extent that men like thin women, they like them in the sense that fatness is sometimes has a genetic component, so that a man in choosing a thin woman as a mate is choosing someone who is going to have more healthy genes to pass on to his children. And the third thing is, where women are indoctrinated, take a look at that skinny ninny Barbie. And my question is, what is the psychological explanation for women, girls who are anorexic, to be able to stand in front of a mirror, thin as a string bean, and think that they are fat? How does that explain?
Well, again, I'm not a clinician, not a psychologist. I'm a historian. I can only tell you what the literature says, and there are some people, in answer to your question, who report that anorectic young women actually have some kind of, may have some kind of cognitive difficulty in actually seeing their bodies realistically. Certainly, they are not willing emotionally to give up their symptom, their precious symptom, which is not eating. So I can't really tell you what the psychological mechanism is there. But the denial of what they're doing and the denial of how unhealthy it is something that is characteristic of anorexia nervosa, both in the 19th century and in the 20th century. I would just like to make a comment about your earlier idea about thinness. And that is, I mean, we really need to understand that medical science has only made thinness a desirable medical condition really in the 20th century. And there are plenty of researchers these days who feel that while obesity is certainly not something that, that is terribly desirable, that its disadvantages are oversold in our current culture.
Well, you hear statistics, and there are more people who die of conditions in which obesity was a factor than there are die of conditions in which tobacco was a factor. So, I mean, those are the statistics that are being given out. So it's not...
Well, I what I'm saying is that there are researchers who would... I don't do this kind of research. There are researchers... such as David Levitsky here at Cornell University, who would dispute the use of those statistics.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think we need to be critical about what science tells us about some of these issues. Again, I'm not speaking against exercise. I'm not speaking in favor of obesity. I'm simply saying that science and medicine do have a cultural component depending upon the value system of the time in which they're generated.
Well, women tend to have a tendency to be either. I mean, people, in fact, have a tendency to be either thin or fat naturally. I mean, I suppose depending.
Oh, genetics are very important. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So that
that, in fact, may be one of the reasons why our diet industry in the United States is such a really a losing proposition.
Yeah.
Except for the people who are selling the diet stuff.
Well, Bill Maher is of the opinion that this, just expressed on his program last night, that this thin body is sold by women and homosexual men to women. That it's a thing that is a product of women's culture and not men's. I mean, you know, the.
Well, again, I don't know if I'm supposed to continue with this one caller, but I think that there are many different reasons why women want to be so slim these days. I wouldn't blame it on homosexual men in the fashion industry. I wouldn't blame it simply on fashion advertising. I wouldn't blame it just on women's culture. I think it's all of those things and more.
Well, you know, all deference to Bill Maher, I think he's a funny guy. I'm not sure he's the greatest social psychologist, but there's one thing that the call touched upon, and that is body image distortions.
Right.
Many women, I mean, if you look at surveys, research looking at this, many women think they're fatter than they really are.
Oh, absolutely. And when asked to choose, you know, ideal body configurations, men do choose body configurations.
Mm.
They're generally heavier than the ones that the women choose,
yeah,
for women.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a way in which our own women's culture contributes to this anxiety. Certainly the whole business of selecting clothes in this culture contributes to the anxiety about size and weight. Although we claim that to have standard sizing in this country, we don't. And we have... let's just say, a lot of discomfort and anxiety in the dressing rooms. It's interesting. I actually at one point tried to find out if there was any anthropological literature on how American women act in dressing rooms when they're trying on clothes.
Mm-hmm.
That's very hard to get at. Maybe the market researchers know, but most of us don't.
Right.
And, you know, we know about the bathing suit anxiety, because every women's magazine in America, starting in May or June, starts addressing that anxiety about how to pick a bathing suit and what kind of bathing suit is best for your figure. And but, you know, we have women all over the country beginning really in, about ages 8, 9, and 10, having difficulty fitting into sizes. And some of that has to do with the fact, as I said, that we have no standard sizing, and we don't buy clothes according to body measurements.
We have a couple other calls to talk with. Let's go on and include them. Next up, a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Very interesting topic. And just to somewhat refute the previous caller, since women's shoes are based on a men's standard, I think that kind of demonstrates the power of men in our culture. But other than wanting to say I do believe anorexia or bulimia probably do have a biological basis and people should please get treatment for anxiety or obsession, I'd like to talk to you about how weight manifests along class lines, because I know you're pointing out that this seems to be a cultural phenomena of the middle class and the rise of the middle class in an industrial society, and I think it's definitely true that eating disorders in general being, I think, the same kind of coin, although maybe different names, that maybe women in lower classes are given permission, or men under stress as well, to attain very large weights, while in upper class societies or middle class societies, I think there's definitely much more stigma to being a...
I think you're absolutely right. And you've probably heard the expression, you can never be too rich or too thin.
Mm.
So those two things are connected. Studies of weight in this culture show that there is stratification by social class. There is more obesity in the working class than there is in the middle and upper classes. This confirms what you've just pointed out. The thing that I would just point out that I think is a little different than what you've just said is that anorexia nervosa still, by and large, remains a middle class and upper class phenomenon. Bulimia, interestingly enough, is much more democratic with a small d. I don't mean the Democratic Party.
Al Gore's.
Okay. I mean it's spread across social classes.
Right. And it has
a somewhat different psychology involved. And
however,
it also is more responsive to psychopharmacological treatment, in other words, to drugs.
Well,
particularly antidepressants.
Yeah, I think that's the main point I would like to make, is whether or not it's endogenous coming from within or exogenous. Certainly, there are treatments that help the psychological treatment, but I think there's also a study that shows women under stress in cultures that are mainly patriarchal, or whatever you want to call it, and women have very little power, is correlated to the weight that women tend to carry. That in societies where women have equal power, they tend to not have as large a proportion of obesity. Well, I'll get off. It's a wonderful topic. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have another caller to talk with, and I want to get right to them, but just one question that sort of raised itself during the last exchange, and that is treatment. It seems that we really haven't cracked that particular nut. We haven't been able to figure out effective treatment in many cases, and that's one of the most frustrating things about anorexia nervosa.
You're absolutely right. It's recalcitrant in many cases. In other cases, of course, it is treatable. I don't know if you had the public broadcasting NOVA, called Dying to Be Thin,
right,
in your area, but I mean, I think there are a number of different cases discussed on that program, and you can see the variety of successes and difficulties, and in some cases there are failures, particularly with anorexia nervosa. With bulimia, my understanding is that the rate of success is much greater.
Let's talk with another listener in Champaign on line number 2 next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. I am an evolutionary biologist, and I actually study attractiveness in animals. And a couple of callers ago, the gentleman attributed the search for good genes to a men's desire for thin women. And
the other way, wouldn't it?
Pardon me, yes, but I think he put it that way. But what I would like to point out is that attractiveness in humans has changed dramatically over the last few centuries, where rather heavy phenotypes have been preferred and considered beautiful, and then it cycles down to thin phenotypes, et cetera, et cetera. And so that there can be no linkage between good genes and body size in women, and thinness or heaviness, and that it's a misnomer to, it's a dangerous thing to apply straight evolutionary thinking to humans because of culture. And that those that do it, such as Randy Thornhill from New Mexico and others, do it in a very shoddy way, and also and often that leads to bad science.
Well, I would agree completely. I do think that the change in the phenotype, as you describe it, I'm going to borrow from your scientific vocabulary. I believe that's culturally driven. Changes in ideals and attractiveness. And I think, what we have now is a situation that may, in fact, be somewhat dangerous because, in fact, the anorexic ideal is really an ideal that certainly doesn't maximize anybody's fertility because an anorectic young woman is not menstruating. People who argue that the current cultural ideal is a part of biological evolution and in the best interest of the species, I find that, it doesn't work.
I agree completely. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Well, we see an example of the sort of the cultural spread of the incidence of anorexia nervosa. I think it points to some interesting things where, for example, industrialism or modern economic system is exported to a place that was more traditionally based. I believe, is it Fiji or one of these places?
There's this great study by Ann Becker at Harvard, where she studied young girls before and after the introduction of television and Western ideals of beauty. And what she found is that among these Fijian girls, the desire to be slimmer occurred after television, in spite of the fact that their culture had a traditional preference for the plump body type. So in other words, the arrival of television and Western cultural values does have an impact. She's not saying that they all developed anorexia nervosa or bulimia. She's simply saying that their sense of self and what makes for an attractive and appropriate body type was changed by the introduction of modern media.
We have about 6 minutes left with our guest, Joan Jacobs-Brumberg, author of Fasting Girls, A History of Anorexia Nervosa. We have one caller waiting. We might be able to squeeze in one more. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Next up, a listener in Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Your guest seemed to make a distinction between anorexia nervosa caused by religion, she referred to somebody in the, 13th century, who was religious. And now she says, of late, the cases of anorexia nervosa are cultural. In either case...
Whether, no, I didn't say that.
Well, yeah.
What I'm really asking you is, if anorexia nervosa in all cases or in most cases is caused by a value package, somebody embracing a value package, how do you make a distinction between cultural and religious?
Well, first of all, I don't think anorexia nervosa is caused simply by a value package, as you call it. That's why I said before it's important to think of it as a multi-determined disorder that involves biology, individual psychology, and culture. Culture alone is not causative. Religious ideas and values are part of a cultural package. And what I do in my book is basically point out that in one time period, the cultural piece was what is technically Christianity, particularly Catholicism, in the case of these medieval 13th century women. Today, the cultural piece is not connected to any particular form of Christianity. In fact, it's more of a secular ideology. It still can have a spiritual dimension to it.
There's an interesting sentence in your book. You write, sadly, the cult of diet and exercise is the closest thing our secular society offers women in terms of a coherent philosophy of the self.
Well, I believe that.
Yeah.
I think that in a way the cult of diet and exercise and its link to our ideas about what it means to be a woman, that is a kind of belief that cuts across all of the churches and synagogues and mosques that we go to when we become American. And while there are some ethnic differences around these questions, we have been socialized to believe that this is a very, very critical piece of female identity. It's very hard for women to give up on this. In fact, there's evidence that indicates that most women in America persist in body dissatisfaction around weight and what they look like well into their the last decade of their life.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is a biological component to that where you have the circumstances where a lot of women are trying to keep their weight down, where a behavior pattern sets in, and at some point there's speculation that this becomes more of a physiological sort of gains physiological inertia, which becomes too powerful to stop. Do you think that that's... a good
way to there is a theory. I think what you're referring to is the addiction model.
Yeah.
That, but what you have to do is think about this as a spectrum disorder. There are people who overeat. There are people who, you know, eat, who overeat only at certain times of the year.
Sure.
Like the one we're living in right at this moment. Then there are people who are careful eaters there, and there are restrictive eaters. These are not dieters, but they're people who all their lives are very, very conscious of their weight. And, you know, when they graduate from high school, and then they have three children, and then they go to, you know, their 50th wedding anniversary, and they're the same weight at all those points in their life. That usually requires, some of it is genetic, but some of it also requires a certain kind of attitude towards food and weight and keeping it all under control. Now, the question for the clinicians, not for me, I'm a historian, the question for the clinicians is, why is it that somebody goes over the line and into the pathology that we know is anorexia nervosa? And that is not simply dieting to lose a set amount of weight. That's not restrictive eating to maintain a weight. That is an unrelenting pursuit of a lower and lower weight. You know, I'll be a happier and better person at 98, then I'll be a happier and better person at 95, and so on, down into a range that is absolutely life-threatening. Now, the issue is that it may be that some people get addicted, they say, again, this is not my research, to the physical sensations and psychological and emotional state that goes along with nutritional deprivation. So, in other words, it's easier for them to get into that unrelenting pursuit of slimness than other people for whom dieting is a laborious and unpleasant activity.
We just have a couple minutes left, and I'm sorry we don't have more time because we have another caller that we won't be able to include. But I wanted to sort of wrap up by asking you, I know you're not a clinician, and you know you don't treat people for anorexia. You studied a long time, and you've looked at history and so forth. There are a couple things that you mentioned at the end of your book that I think are very interesting and possibly helpful for folks. And one of those suggestions is that in dealing with these sort of cultural obsessions with thinness, each of us needs to assess the extent to which we've bought into that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that women in particular need to stop reading each other's bodies. And by that, I mean, every time you see someone, are you assessing whether or not she is thinner or heavier? What do you say out loud? Oh, you look so great. You've lost 10 pounds. That kind of stuff, you know, if you think about it, has an enormous amount of impact on little girls. When we meet our granddaughters, what are we saying to them? Are we constantly referencing how they look? Oh, you look adorable. Instead of saying, you know, what's going on today? How was school? Have you dropped the training wheels on your bike? What's your favorite bedtime story? We need to divert our attention away from the body to the mind and to other ways in which women are creative and active and social.
Well, I'm sorry we don't have more time. We're going to have to leave it there, but I'll suggest for folks, if you'd like to learn more on this subject, you could look at the book Fasting Girls, The History of Anorexia Nervosa. The author is Joan Jacobs Brumberg, last name spelled Brumberg. This book is just recently published in paperback by Vintage. So I'm sure you could find that. And to you, Joan Jacobs-Brumberg, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. Very intelligent questions.
We have a good group of listeners.
Yeah, you do.
Thanks.